Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome to the NIDS View, a weekly show on the NIDS Podcasting Network. I'm your host, Jim Petrosky, and often when Curtis or Adam are not on the show, we announce that they are on assignment, but I must be truthful to our audience. Today, they're out goofing off. So you're stuck with me as the host, but I'm delighted to be joined by former Congressman Chris Stewart and NIDS' very own Chief of Staff, China expert Dr. Alex Littlefield. Greeting, gentlemen.
Greeting, James.
Great to be with you, James, and thanks for not introducing me as a China expert, because that's Alex and you. It's going to be a fun conversation, though.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, no, I agree. We all have our thing to do, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. But before we launch into our discussion, I want the audience to know that if you're interested in what we look like and how we interact, you should check us out on our recently released YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube, type in The NIDS View, and it'll come up, and you can see this and a few other of the podcasts that were launched since we launched this channel. And it's meant to give you yet another inside look into how we interact during the show. Let you feel like you're in our living rooms or dining rooms or back behind Chris playing his guitar. I'm not sure. Whichever of those things. So here we go. Well, today we're going to be discussing a recent publication by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists released in January this year. This article is titled Chinese Nuclear Weapons 2024. I think it's part of their notebook series. And I'll admit, I don't regularly read the articles from this organization, but Alex Littlefield assigned it to me. And I found it intriguing that they attempted to calculate the Chinese arsenal. And I hope that discussions we have can include what might be concluded from the size and the types of weapons that are listed in this article. And additionally, in episode 51 of this show, that was titled, Are We in a Cold War with China? We said we'd do a show on this specific topic. So here we are. So, Alex, since you're our true China expert, I'll give you the first word on your thoughts about this notebook report, and we'll begin there. Go ahead.
The article pretty much borrows from open sources here. So it's trying to pin down what the weapons are, how many missiles there are, and about project out to the future what there will be. Probably my overall first impression is that in terms of doctrine or policy or strategy, they basically just adopt and parrot the party line that there is no new change, that China's policy hasn't changed since 64, that it's just a no first use, and that whatever growth, whatever changes, it's just adapting to developments of the world strategic situation. So China is just responding to the environment rather than in any ways transforming the environment. And they even go to quote one of the foreign affairs articles that was recently written that also basically said that China was just responding to the United States. So a little bit disappointing there on that front. And then while they do have their list of weapons and the yield of the weapons, they did miss a few. So I didn't see any mention of the DF-41X, which can be MIRVed up to 10 warheads, or any mention of DF-45 or DF-51. So it still seems a little bit incomplete there.
Interesting. Chris, you look like you were going to jump in.
Well, again, I'm really not a China expert. I think my time in Congress on the 11 years on the Intelligence Committee gave me some insights, though. And, you know, I think there's a couple things worth noting here. To Alex's point about, China claiming they're responding to the U.S., well, I would ask, or the changing environment, I would ask, well, what has changed? I mean, the United States nuclear force structure and nuclear posture has been the same for 20 years. Nothing has changed there. And in fact, I would think we could argue that the U.S. nuclear force capabilities has diminished over the last 20 years, which is something that a lot of us are concerned about. And the second thing is, I thought the article was actually for open source, it was really pretty good. It was extensive. It was fairly authoritative. It was broad, in the sense that they hit a lot of the, I think, almost all or maybe all of the main topics that I think you would expect or hope that would come out of this conversation. I do think that they're probably conservative in estimating China's capabilities. I think actually China has more capability than this article indicated. And of course, if we were to talk specifics on that, that would be a very sensitive topic and one that the intelligence community would be very guarding of, because obviously they don't want to reveal our insights and how we get those insights. And, again, I'm not saying that they're off the mark entirely. I don't think they are. But if anything, the threat that this article is trying to enumerate is probably more than they are able to say, but than they're able to determine, and potentially in some specific cases, it's substantially more. Point being that it would just be foolishness to not take this new development, this recent development over the last few years, very seriously. To my earlier point, and then James, I'd be interested to see what you think. You know, China had the capability 10 years ago, 20 years ago, to develop a nuclear force, a much more substantial nuclear force than they ever did. And yet they chose not to do that. And they had the capability. I mean, they've always had a very small, a limited nuclear force. They clearly had the technical capability to do it. They had the financial capability if they'd made a decision to do that. For heaven's sakes, if Iran and some other nations such as India and others can muster the force and the money to build a nuclear force, then China certainly could as well. And yet, once again, they didn't. And we have to ask ourselves, well, why didn't they 10 years ago? Why didn't they 20 years ago? And it can't be because the United States has changed, because we haven't changed. And I think the answer is very clear. And from a policymaker point of view, this is the key to this. And that is, China is willing to challenge the United States in ways that they weren't 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. And not only are they committed to challenging the United States, they're committed to being able to dominate the United States. And this is just one example. It's not the only one, but this is one example of that. They've said, we were deficient in this capability. We're going to address it, and we're going to do it really, really quickly. And that's what we're witnessing right now. A few years ago, we wouldn't have imagined that China would be able to develop this capability and be able to do it in a number of years, something that took us nearly a generation, that they're going to be able to do it in less than half a decade, I think. And we have to, again, recognize, okay, well, why does that matter? And to be able to develop policies on how we will meet that challenge.
Yeah, but if you take this article on faith, and I know Alex said they're towing the party line and saying that this is completely a defensive posture, could there be other reasons why they're taking this action now? That perhaps maybe China, I don't understand the history of China as well as maybe Alex does, so maybe you can fill me in here. But when I read this, I said, wow, they finally have the capability of doing this. Why they didn't do it before was because maybe they didn't have the capability. They didn't have the resources. They weren't available. And so they were caught in a position where they couldn't do it. Is that a possibility, Alex? Or do we see something different in the strategic change and, strategic environment for them? Because I agree with Chris. It looks like, our capabilities have sort of wasted away, if you will, since 1992. And that doesn't seem to be the structure. So could there be other forces at work here? What are your thoughts, Alex?
I think they've been more consistent through the years. It's just that they've slowly making progress, slowly continuing to improve both quantity and quality and delivery methods, and you're just seeing that exponentially moving faster, accelerating faster and faster. But it's a trajectory they've been on already for a while. And so I don't think there's a change there with that. But we are feeling the change now, because now if you look in like IR theory, power transition theory, now we're starting to see we are being eclipsed. And it felt fine when we were more powerful. But now that we are no longer, we're facing someone who is not just a peer competitor, but arguably stronger than us, at least with nuclear in the nuclear realm, that now we're nervous and we say, hey, what happened? This seems to have happened overnight. But it was actually happening all along. But we just were a little bit too lazy or unconcerned with what China was doing until they got to the point where they are now. And it's not just them too. I know today's China, but the Russians as well. So we would have difficulty facing one or the other down, let alone both of these countries. And then on top of that, you have North Korea continuing to develop. So this is these days are more dangerous than they were during the Cold War, when it was just the Soviet Union. And on top of all of that, our military, the numbers of the troops, the number of people in active duty is as low as it's probably ever been. And our equipment's as old as it's ever been. So fewer numbers on our part, fewer numbers of people, older equipment. While we're getting weaker and weaker, the world around us is getting stronger and stronger.
Yeah. And now, you know, I took that sort of contrarian view just to get sort of a little bit deeper into this, because I agree. You can, if you look at the number, you know, the number and the escalation, to me, and people have listened to this podcast before, it's not just the number of capabilities, not just the nuclear weapons, but the delivery capabilities and the foray of delivery capabilities that sort of concerned me, but the ability to expand. They've already primed the pump of building weapons, of building new systems. So their ability to expand that, you know, I always say it's a calculus problem, right? It's not the change, it's the rate of change. And the rate of change seems to be expanding from this article. When you look at 2006, I think they gave one example, in 2010, and it's incredible how quickly it's coming up. You're saying exponentially. I'm not sure quite follows that model. I'm a scientist, so it have to fit the exponential model perfectly. But it is definitely an expanding nonlinear expansion, and that is that's concerning, because it takes time, because we're behind them on this whole ordeal. Chris,
well, maybe a couple thoughts. You know, it's when we have these conversations, whether it's with you or whether it's with other, you know, people who work in defense industry or policymakers, you know, senior leadership in our military at the Pentagon, even ambassadors and people overseas. And we have a conversation similar to what we've had here today. There's a little part of me that goes, you know, make sure that what you're saying is true. Make sure you're not Chicken Little, that, you know, we're not just out there, the sky's falling, and everyone should be scared, and we got to spend a lot of money on defense. But every once in a while, the things that you say, when we say that our military has atrophied, when we say that China's military is, as you said, maybe not growing exponentially, but in their nuclear posture, it's growing at an incredible rate and at a rapidly accelerating rate. I mean, that's just demonstrably true. And, you know, it took a leader like Ronald Reagan to come and to wake the American people up and to say, we are going to be able to defend America's interest after a decade of weakness, after a decade of America being diminished in the world's eyes and in the eyes of leadership around the world. And I think we're at that moment once again, where the world views us as not being nearly as strong as they need us to be, as many of them want us to be. Our allies certainly want us to be. And we've got to really address that. And this is one of the things we're going to have to address. Look, a conflict in the South China Sea. And we always think about the Straits of Taiwan or with Taiwan, but I was with the ambassador of the Philippines a few weeks ago, and we were having dinner. He said something, you know, you all focus on the South China Sea, but what about the Philippines? What about other allies in the region? They're equally frightened. And it may be that, you know, the conflict, if there is some, you know, that happens, and we pray that it doesn't, but it's not just Taiwan. But that potential conflict changes dramatically now that China has something they didn't have before, and that's a viable nuclear posture, a viable nuclear deterrence. It allows them to be more aggressive than they would have been able to be before because of that backstop. It changes the dynamics of how we respond. It's much more difficult now. And again, I just think we need leadership that recognizes that and has developed policies that will address that.
The one thing I think is interesting with China and the way they're approaching this, that I'd be curious as your thoughts on this, is how China can get away with keeping a policy of, we're not going to be part of an arms race, and then they build more weapons. You know, we're here just for defensive posture, but they're building bombers. They're building very provocative, offensive weaponry in order to, you know, advance themselves. And I'm curious about the Chinese culture and how that would be, you know, how does that fit into the way China operates strategically? And then, of course, our response strategically, because I agree, Chris, what ends up happening is it seems like leadership takes those statements almost as full value oftentimes. And It's hard to connect that to what is reality on the ground. You know, where's that disconnect come from? And from the hubris, if you will, of the Chinese government, how can you say that and know that we are aware of these kinds of things? Does that fit into the way that China operates, Alex?
I believe China is behaving in a very rational way. And when we say that, they're going to say, of course, that they are just defensive and it's just a deterrent, but they're definitely have great first strike capabilities with the fractional orbit ballistic systems and the hypersonic glide. And actually right now, because Russia's economy is struggling, the Russians are exporting enriched uranium U-235 to China, which is used for nuclear weapons. So that didn't factor into this report. So the Chinese are very much, if not exponentially, but to use a pun, because we have a lot of puns on this program, they are accelerating rapidly with the uranium. And it's consistent with what they want, right? They want to be a world power. There's no reason they shouldn't want to be a world power. And for that to happen, they need to first be a regional power. And for that to happen, they need to get that thing that's blocking their access to the Pacific Ocean and all kinds of things. They need to get a hold of Taiwan, which they use historical arguments why that is their island. So I think everything they're doing is fine and consistent in terms of going towards what they're aiming for.
You know, one thing you have to give them credit for is that, you know, they're actually being honest about their ambitions. Mm-hmm. If you read and understand the Belt Road Initiative, it's really clear. They intend to be by the 100th anniversary of the creation of the Communist Party in China, which is 2048, they intend to be, and they state this, we will be the world's dominant power militarily, diplomatically, economically, culturally, and they're moving methodically towards that goal. Now, there's going to be obstacles in the way, and some of that is not turning out even in the last few years as well for them as it was before, because the world is waking up to that. You've got African nations who are realizing that they're 100% exploiting them for their natural resources, mm-hmm. for example. I can take you to multiple cities in Africa that have had China come in and build ports or other facilities, maybe airports, and they bring in Chinese workers. Those workers live on a compound. It's actually a walled compound. They don't ever go into the community. They spend none of the money they're making there. When the project is complete, they take those Chinese workers home and they leave that nation with enormous debt. And in some cases, still limited access to the port that they allowed to be built on their land. I mean, Djibouti is a great example of that. The greatest advocate we have in really around the world, but especially in African nations, is leadership of Djibouti, who will meet with African leaders and say, don't do what we did. We gave them access. They came in and exploited it. They expanded it without our permission. They've taken rights regarding airspace or expanded the scope of the defense posture of that base beyond what we originally agreed to. So again, China hasn't, and they won't be able to do this without some opposition, but it's really clear still what their goal is. And then one last thing, and James, I know I've shared this on the program, at least I think I have, but allow me to just, you know, remind listeners and others of this one experience I had 5 or 6 years ago, meeting with very, very senior Chinese leadership, very structured meeting. We were told we could ask one question and not to respond, just to listen. And mm-hmm. and I ask, I don't want to say who, but a very senior Chinese leader, you know, the Thucydides trap, this idea that if you have an emerging nation and an established power, that they will always come into conflict. And once again, as I think I pointed out, in the last 500 years, 80% of the time, that's true. And I ask him, do you think that's inevitable? Will China and the United States, as you are an emerging power, is it inevitable that we come into conflict? And he said, no, we don't believe that at all. We have our regional interest. We have our economic interests. In some cases, we have the same interest. Fighting terrorism, for example, he used in his example. Although when he said that, I thought of their treatment of the Uyghurs in Western China, that they suppress under the guise of anti-terrorism, which is just nonsense. But to finish the story very quickly, had a chance to meet with this individual a couple years ago and had the same conversation and reminded him and asked him once again, do you think that's still inevitable? Do you think that, you know, you have your interests, we have ours, we won't come into conflict? And this time he said, well, I guess we'll see. And I just think that's very illustrative that, you know, their attitudes have changed. And honestly, their confidence has increased. And I think if he'd answered the question honestly the first time, he would have said, well, we'll see. But he didn't want to have that confrontation. He didn't want to have that on the table. But now they're not afraid to do that. Well, we'll see who is the world's dominant power, whether it's a democracy, whether it's a culture and a nation that represents, you know, human rights and freedom, economic rights, economic growth, or whether it's a culture such as we see with the Chinese Communist Party that represents everything exactly opposite of that.
Yeah, certainly the ability to coerce others into your understanding, or at least do that in a way that with the power that they have, is new in terms of China's operations on the block, if you will. And that's, I think that's something that we see in nuclear weapons. You know, when you talk about disarmament, it goes the other way. If we disarm, we lose that kind of leverage for peaceful, good purposes, valuable stability purposes that's lost here as China emerges here, which is why I go back to my comment about how China can, you know, still state their purpose, that they would never, I think, let me get the exact quote so I don't get charged for not quoting them incorrectly, said, China is always committed to a nuclear policy of no first use of nuclear weapons at any time or and under any circumstances, and not using or threatening to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states or nuclear weapon free zones unconditionally. China, and this is my point here, China does not engage in any nuclear arms race with any other country and keeps its nuclear capabilities at the minimum level. We'll stop there. And I'm glad in this document here they at least... the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists at least acknowledges How do you define minimum? And I know if you go back to previous podcasts in this show, you know, we talk about what is a minimum deterrence. You know, and I always argue the minimal deterrence that was effective during the Cold War was whatever we had because we prevented a nuclear war. So obviously that was the minimum we needed because we didn't coerce someone into starting a war and we didn't open the door for them to start one. So it's hard to do in foresight. It's easier to do in hindsight. And so maybe it would be interesting to hear from both of you. What would we define as an arms race? Because they're saying, this isn't part of an arms race. Well, then what in the world is it aside from a show of force, as Chris is saying? And I'm not even sure it's as much a show of force as it's actually almost, I hate to say it this way, bullying, because it gets overused, but almost bullying the world into saying we're moving. Try to stop us. It's almost, you know, a dare me is the way I see it. And this report really cinched that with me, because even if their projections are low, and I would say I'm surprised they're arguing them low, but whether they're low or not, it still equates to a very major threat from multiple platforms and multiple directions with nuclear forces. So arms race, Alex, what do you think?
We don't need to restrict ourselves by thinking, oh, this is an arm race and we will not engage in it. This is one of the issues the Americans have had, like this is a bad thing. We cannot do it. We can by no means let it happen. So we're going to be the greater power. We're going to take the initiative and we're going to reduce our arms. We're going to allow our nuclear capability to get very old and outdated. But the result wasn't what we were supposed to have seen, which was, okay, we're not a threat, therefore other countries won't perceive us as a threat, so they also won't develop their nuclear capability. But what's happened is while we were being the gentlemen and giving way, that was taken advantage of. So now what's happened is we're left far, far behind. And now what we can't do, because we don't have the ability now to engage in an arms race, at the very least, the very minimum, all we can do now is engage in an arms catch up because we're so far behind. So it's already taken that privilege of beginning an arms race or staying ahead of an arms race has kind of already gotten away from us.
Yeah. I think, you know, even the terms arms race, for those, you know, James, you and I who are a little bit older, you know, that was a term we grew up with all the time, right? There was always talk about the arms race and detente. And, you know, when Reagan met with Gorbachev, it was a big, big deal. The whole world watched, you know, would they be able to come to an agreement? And I remember once they walked away from the talks, I think they were both in Iceland, as I recall, seems like Reykjavik, but I could be wrong. But I mean, when they walked away from those agreements, I mean, the world noticed and kind of shook the world. And, you know, it's not something that we think about much any longer. You know, we have our established forces. We know Russia had theirs, and Russia, by the way, was cheating on those, and especially on the intermediate and short range capabilities that, you know, that they continue to cheat. And finally, we withdrew from the treaty because we thought, why have a treaty that restricts us when they're not adhering to the treaty? So I think it's an idea that goes back, you know, like kind of like shag carpet. It was popular in the 70s and but not so much anymore. But it's one that we're going to have to, I think, bring back and resurrect. And that is, are we being competitive in deterrence with emerging threats that we didn't have to concern ourselves just a few years ago? And that's a fair question to ask. And then what do we do if we decide that we're not, that we don't have the adequate deterrence? And some people say, well, we're engaging in an arms race with China. That's not our intention. But we, at the same time, have to be able to defend America's security. And to answer that question definitively, we can defend ourselves.
But Chris, wouldn't you say your very logical view of what we should do is exactly what China's doing? They're assessing what their strategy is, and they're building the necessary armament capability, defensive posture, offensive posture, economic posture to meet those needs, desires as a strategy. But where are we as a, but where are we in the US with our, you know, our long-term vision of what we're seeking aside from, aside from status quo. And I will say, I have a difficulty arguing just status quo, because if you're status quo, your adversaries are going to just continue to walk around you. You know, I used to, my grandkids play basketball, and at the age of 12, you have this tendency to stand still and wait for the basketball to come to you. And it never comes to you because you're not moving. You've always got to be reacting to everyone else. And we should be ahead of, you know, not reacting to others, but we should be ahead of that reaction. So we're driving the train and not someone else. But I feel that's where we are right now. Is that what you're getting to, Chris?
Well, I think that's a good description of it. And, you know, I don't disagree with that. You know, China, maybe one last comment on that, and that is China's leadership. And, you know, for a period of time there, most Americans, and I think probably most of the West, they didn't view China as a threat because, you know, militarily they just weren't, not like they are now, obviously. And they didn't act aggressive towards their neighbors or towards Taiwan or against the West. But that's changed. It's different now, and their capabilities are different now. And China's leadership is acting consistently with what they've said their long-term goals are. As I've already said, the Belt Road Initiative, their ambitions to lead the world, their actions now are consistent with achieving that goal. And so, as you said, we can stand still and the basketball dribbles around us, or we can be aware and thoughtful and hopefully make good decisions to counter that.
I would be remiss in this podcast to not give the Adam question what he always gives to me. So I'm going to give myself the Adam question. You guys can add it in, but I'm always asked, well, since you're the technology guy, can you comment on a technology issue? And there's one in here that's sort of buried deep into the nuclear work. And that is the comment on China building a dual use nuclear materials and reactor capability. In other words, they are building reactors, these high temperature salt reactors that are used for power production, but at the same time, they're using them for plutonium production. They're doing dual use, which actually is a very efficient way to do two important things that they're working on. And I was surprised that that's open, one. And number two, that there's no comment in this article about how other countries have sort of put that aside. We are not going to build the military characteristics into our commercial characteristics for a variety of reasons. And I think that it might be a fallacy that we're not doing that efficiently, because we could be producing material that we need in a nuclear renaissance, per se, in the US. And China seems to have said, I'm going to take the efficient route, and I'm going to get two for one. I'm going to get nuclear materials, and I'm going to get power that I need to build my economy to make me stronger for the Beltway Initiative, et cetera. And I thought it was an interesting thing. It was sort of just buried in this article. It was, I think, one or two sentences. And out of all the things I read, which were, again, I agree with Chris when he said up front, it was well-resourced, well-cited article that provides a lot of facts to digest. But that little fact was just buried in there with very little comment. And I think it's a rather interesting thing that most people don't see. Any last comments, since I gave my technical comment because Adam's not here, I'll let you guys have the last word. So maybe Chris and then Alex, being our China expert, any last word on this article or anything else that was said?
You know, I'll just briefly say once again, U.S. doesn't seek conflict. We don't seek to dominate the world. We don't seek to impose our values on other nations. And in the times that it's appeared that we tried to do that, it has failed. But at the same time, we have to seek to defend our way of life We represent, whether we like it or not, we represent, you know, so much hope to the rest of the world, and they're counting on us. So we just have to be strong, not just for them, but primarily for our own future, for the future of our children. And I'm not running around with my hair on fire. I'm not predicting the end of the world or a nuclear catastrophe. I'm just saying let's be careful, let's be clear-eyed, and let's be thoughtful in how we view the world and how we respond to the world.
China, they're facing some very big structural problems with demographics, with the economy, with the legitimacy of the party, and all of these things don't bode well for China over the long term. So that's going to probably speed up their timeline to try and make a big change to the status quo, because the status quo as it is does not work in their favor. And so it's clear probably to the people in the party what the threats are to their survival. But for us here in the United States, we don't seem to see what the threats are to us. And what we've identified as threats are probably not the actual things that are going to bring the downfall of this civilization. It's going to be external, from somebody who desires to take our place as a hegemon, who desires to lead a new world order. And so that, because they have that desire and they have that sense of urgency, there's no reason they can't make it happen. And they will use first use. There's no way they won't. They say they won't, but they will. If they've already threatened non-nuclear powers with nuclear use, such as Japan. If they said if Japan intervened in Taiwan, they would attack with nuclear response. They create situations, circumstances that can make it appear that they had been hurt. Like with the EP3 incident, or if you run your bike out into the street and get hit by a car, you can say, hey, this car killed my child, but hey, you told your child to run out in front of the car on your bike. So they do that every day down in South China Sea with Philippines, with the U.S. and so on. So they're constantly setting themselves up to have a confrontation, to have a conflict, and then to say it was the other guy's fault. And then at that point, they will say they are now within their rights to respond in a very harsh and fast manner. So they know what they're doing, and we don't know what we're doing. And so for that, I give them credit.
Okay. Well, there's the final word from our two guests today, Alex Littlefield and Chris Stewart. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming in. This was my debut hosting of the NIDS View. And if you want to give us some feedback, send it to asknids@thinkdeterrence.com. And that would get you to us to get your feedback. You can give feedback on my hosting or anything else that you would like to add to our show, to include adding yourself as a guest or giving us some ideas on future subjects. And for Curtis and Adam, when you listen to this, hopefully you're done goofing off and you've returned to the show next week for our normal hosting. But until next time, thank you for listening. We enjoy our audience. And as always, think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.